Welcome to the City Confessions. I'm Marianne Yip, a native New Yorker, and I'm here to discuss all the thoughts that go through the minds of people living in New York City. Since I'm a native who was born and raised in the city that never sleeps, I come across people who are constantly in a rush. I would like to take a moment to sit down and talk about what's on their minds and what keeps them up at night. So sit back and let's dive into these confessions of people I know and people I just met. Hello guys, I hope you're all doing well. Welcome back to the City Confessions, and this week's episode will actually be the last one of the third season before I release my solo one next week. So I'm super, super excited. Today I have Asha Terry. She's an author and award-winning community mental health advocate, psychotherapist, and certified life coach. She also has 20 years of experience providing evaluations, diagnoses, treatment, and life-enhancing skills to children, adults, families, and couples. And I can go on and on about her impressive bio, but I would love her to introduce herself. So, hi, Asha. How are you? And welcome.
Hi, Marianne. I'm well. Thank you for inviting me onto your show. How are you?
I'm doing well. I mean, I think doing the best I can is what I normally say. But yes, so thank you so much for being on, and I'm so, so happy to have you because of your background, and I think you can add so much value to the audience because I know today's topics are going to be extremely relevant to what's going on in the world right now. But before we dive in, can you introduce yourself and give the listeners background about what you do, who you are, and your bio, I guess.
I'd love to. So as you stated, I'm an author. I just wrote my forthcoming book, Adulting as a Millennial, A Guide to Everything Your Parents Didn't Teach You, which is really mostly for millennials, but it's also for people who know millennials. And so you may not be in that generation, but it does help to examine the ways that we show up in our lives. How do we get out of our heads and into our present lives? And that's what I help people to do in my coaching practice as a life coach. And as a therapist, I help to challenge these thoughts that we have and beliefs we hold true about the past and or the future with folks who suffer from anxiety and other mood disorders. So as an author, as a coach, as a psychotherapist, I'm really the person who is the person to connect people back to themselves, mm-hmm. or to help them feel empowered themselves to do the things that they feel confident about, mm-hmm. and competent in, while also contributing to the greater society and living a prosperous life.
Yeah, I think that's so amazing. But why don't we rewind a little bit? Where did you grow up? And I know that you basically, well, I guess your job right now, you have clients from like internationally as well, correct?
Well, presently no, but I have had international clients because right. I used to see clients remote before this whole remote virtual thing was a big to-do, mm-hmm. and did some coaching with couples, but also I used to consult with Thrive Global, which is a company founded by Arianna Huffington.
Oh, wow. I love her. She's so inspiring.
Yeah, she's very inspiring. Yeah. Her book, Fearless, was mm-hmm. the book that inspired my life the most in the last couple of years, but I used to do work with Thrive Global to help prevent workplace burnout by teaching people mindfulness strategies and how to live more mindfully. So that was where the international piece came in, bigger than ever, because I had clients from all around Europe and other parts of the world. But now, as I think you were going into this question, I imagine, as a therapist that's working remote 100% of the time, I see clients mostly from my state, which is New York, and I'm from New York originally. Born in Brooklyn, New York.
Oh my God, I love that. I'm a native too, and I'm currently living in Brooklyn. So shout out to being a New Yorker.
That's right. Shout out to being a New Yorker, BK resident. That's right. And I'm proud of that for so many reasons. I actually just read this interesting stat the other day that said 1 in 7 Americans can trace their ancestry back to Brooklyn.
Really?
Americans. Yeah.
Wait, that's insane.
That is, but it's also interesting why when I go places out of state, I find so many people that can tell me they know someone or had someone from New York.
Yes.
You know, and they'll bring it back to Brooklyn specifically. So, yeah, I'm a native New Yorker, a Brooklynite, and my work has been through probably three of the five boroughs. I've worked in New York City, Manhattan, which is also where my primary office was when we were open. And I've worked in the Bronx. That's where I started my career as a counselor, in the South Bronx specifically. And I have worked in Brooklyn now as adjacent to working to Manhattan with both remote work and community work.
This is why you're the perfect guest for my podcast, because the whole point of it is it's obviously called The City Confessions, and I was really inspired by Humans of New York. I'm sure you are familiar with them, and just telling stories, because I feel like New Yorkers specifically, we're so interesting. We wear so many hats, and I feel like when you meet somebody, they're not just ever one thing. And I thought it would be so interesting to kind of create this platform where we can all share stories, because even though we all live different lives, I know that we share common, you know, struggles and feelings. I love hearing that.
Thank you. I think this is a great platform with a wonderful title, because City Confessions, I used to have an issue with the term confession. I used to think about my Catholic school days and having to confess my sins. And when I started therapy many years ago, I felt like I was in confession. But I worked that through, of course. But yeah, I love the title, because as an author and as a writer, I blog as well on my website. I recognized that when I started writing my book, I had so many stories to tell. I'm still a young woman, and I went back into my earliest memories of my childhood, and where I had the privilege of being around people who had great identity of self, and I carried that story all the way up to my present day life in my book to share different anecdotes that really helped to grow me and stretch me in ways that were uncomfortable, and people who mentored me. So yeah, City Confessions is a great title and a great platform to talk about stories, especially someone like myself who has a lot of stories to tell.
Yes. Thank you. I love that. So let's actually dive in. So there's a lot going on in the world right now. I know that, I mean, I did not foresee any of this, one being the pandemic, and then the second, which is the injustice that's happening, that has been happening, and it's, you know, like, enough is enough. So there's a lot, and I feel like there's so many questions I want to ask you, but why don't we begin with just the topic of anxiety? And I feel like me personally, I experience anxiety, and I think it's a term that some people loosely use, and I think there's still misconceptions around anxiety. So can you just clarify, or in your own words, what is anxiety, and how can people manage their anxiety during this whole pandemic?
Thank you for asking that question. We use a lot of terms in our jargon these days that mean something, and oftentimes after a while gets overused. And that's what I'm hearing you say. Anxiety is on a spectrum, but what it is a mental health disorder, and it's characterized by intense feelings of worry and fear that interfere with people's daily activities. So how it presents is a really clear example: someone who has rapid speech, someone who might have trouble sitting still for prolonged periods of time, someone who has difficulty shutting their brains off after work or the end of their day so that they can actually relax and then eventually go into a deep REM sleep. When we see anxiety in relationships, what I notice as a clinician is we see where people are not present to the small moments that exist, because they're either jumping ahead into the future, worried about what's going to happen, globalizing things, catastrophizing events in their mind, to going all the way in the past and ruminating, as we call it, where you're overthinking and thinking things through very detailed, and your critique of your thinking to what happened, what you could have said or done differently, what this person did or said to you. So you're missing the moments because you're living out of the present. And that's what's going on in a lot of people's minds, where they're jumping ahead or they're living behind themselves. But the other signs point to the body movement, the rapidness of how we move, the rapidness in how we speak, the interruptions in our speech from one topic to the other, that switches pretty quickly. Those are the ways that you can point to people having anxious experiences, I like to call them, instead of being anxious. Mm-hmm. This is not a characteristic. Mm-hmm. It's an experience. It's a way of living out of yourself, outside of yourself. And it's on a spectrum like anything else. So when people say they feel anxious, they may feel anxious. They know in their bodies what restless energy they feel. And it could be mild to very severe, when someone is completely crippled by anxiety, which would look more like something of an obsessive compulsive disorder.
Got it. Okay, so people with anxiety, right now, what are your, I guess, tips on how to handle it, or advice? Because I feel like people keep saying it's a time that, you know, none of us saw coming, we're not familiar with. You know, we are forced to stay home. We are bombarded with news, and sometimes the news are very like controversial and contradict each other. So it leaves us with feeling somewhat helpless. What are your advice on how to handle that?
One of the things I would say is identify what you can control. Mm-hmm. The helpless feeling, it's partly a learned behavior. It's learned to be helpless. Yes, there's some things that are out of our control. Natural occurrences, such as a pandemic, is out of our control. But you can control turning on the news. You can turn off the news too. You can control turning your notifications on social media or turning it off. You could download an app onto your phone to time you and alert you when it's going to shut off your app, so that you're not checking and scrolling online for long periods of time. So we do have those things within our control. Also, just looking into, again, our relationships, because I do a lot of work with relationships, what I stated first was more of what the individual can do. But when you're in relationship with someone at work, at home, in your social circles, what you can also do is help people to recognize that they're having an experience. And so if you are able to be a safe haven for someone to share their experience with it, you might be more equipped, if you have the knowledge or information, to give them language around what they're feeling, to ask more questions so that they could process their thoughts differently. That's something that a lot of friends do for each other. But also, when it gets to a certain point, right, and when people cannot do that for their friends, then it's important to point them in the direction of a professional who can help. This is the first time in history where myself as a clinician has seen there not being those barriers. There's still some barriers, but those barriers that we once had with people seeking treatment, because if you have access to the internet, you can sign on to a provider online, mm-hmm. and do treatment anywhere in the world. So those are the ways that we can help ourselves, and those are the ways we can help people around us. And then those are the resources that are available to helping people, from paid resources, such as paying a provider or joining a support group that might be funded by a grant, or an online network that's free through a Facebook group or through a yoga or meditation or mindfulness group. Those are the different individual and collective ways that people can seek help and receive help.
Right. And I hear you speaking a lot about, you know, online resources, but with social media being the forefront of our generation and society right now, I want to ask you, do you think it helps with what's going on in the world? You know, being that it's almost like the first time where we globally are all going through this together in a way, right? The pandemic, it's affecting everybody. Or do you think it actually hurts people in a way, or serve as, you know, this like burden, just because there's so much information out there and, you know, social media can be overwhelming? So I just want to know from your experience, also considering that you are a writer and you have wrote, or that your latest book is called Adulting as a Millennial, I just want to see what your intake is on the social media's role on our mental health.
Yeah, so as someone who's on a cusp of two generations, the millennial generation and Generation X, mm-hmm. when I was in high school, I think it was, that was the onset of computers being used with the internet. Mm-hmm. So there were computers when I was a little kid that were coming into people's homes. And if you were able to afford it, you could. But when I got to high school, that was when people were going beyond just the library to get information for their school papers, so we could just, you know, turn to the World Wide Web, as they were calling it at that time. And really called it the whole, you know, www.
Yep.
And so growing up and then becoming an adult and not having social media until maybe I was like in my 30s, did I see this becoming like really prominent in how people socialize and connected with one another? So I was in some ways late to the game with going online and being social that way, because I was of a generation that you actually socialize in person. And it is quite striking to me, and I had to adapt to it myself, to be honest, in my work, that when I would talk to clients about having conversations with friends or partners, and instead of dating through apps initially, like actually meeting people spontaneously, it was odd to me that folks were responding with a lot of anxiety, a lot of fear around having face-to-face meetups or dialoguing with people, or not learning how to be social when they were younger, so feeling very socially awkward as an adult, where that wasn't so different for us to be socially awkward at times. We embraced it. We allowed ourselves to be sort of goofy and work that out. And for some people, that became like their secret sauce in terms of how they connected to people. But the millennial generation, I think, deals so much with perfectionism, mm-hmm. that not having the right quote thing to say or the right look for whatever that means, represents a lot to people, and it's created a fraudulence around who people really are in the world. So what I say is that, like, your doctor will say that you should have carbs, but try to choose the healthier carbs, like go for the sweet potato fries, right, versus the white bean fries. It's the same kind of thing with social media. It's a tool. And like anything else, Marianne, tools are used for different purposes, and people have good reason to use social media, and other people have a platform that social media is gaining them attention and, you know, jobs even, and prominence. But if we don't have the discipline to know when we should tune away from it because we're spending too much time in front of our devices and not enough time actually in the world, in real spaces with human beings, then that's problematic. Mm-hmm. And I don't want to underestimate the intelligence of a young adult who knows that. You know when you've been online too much. You know when it's starting to like go into your resting, sleeping cycle, and you notice that 6 hours later you're so exhausted because you spent 3 or 4 hours on YouTube going from one clip to the next clip. It's such a mysterious thing, but it's also at times a very provocative thing, because sometimes people are surprised how these videos and these threads come up in their feeds, but then at the same time they can't seem to stop themselves, because chemically there is a reaction from the brain to the finger in how we use these devices. And so when we get the alert, when we get the notice, when we get the thing that stimulates our brain more, then we are compelled chemically to be more attracted to that and to stay on that thread. And that's really, in some ways, kind of wicked, but it's work because it sells.
Mm-hmm. Wow, that was really interesting. I never looked at it that way, just because I feel like my background, like I'm kind of in it and it's somewhat of my job, but it's really, yeah, it's different to hear somebody else speak about it from that perspective. And I think this is a good transition to the injustice that's happening specifically in the United States. And obviously I'm referring to George Floyd's murder. And it's just a hard topic because honestly, I feel like it's relevant. It's happening right now, but the past 2 weeks has been so difficult for me. And I know it's been difficult for other people. And I've been experiencing a wide range of emotions from, you know, being mad and sad and overwhelmed and anxious. And I want to personally ask you how you are doing and how you are managing what's happening in the world.
I appreciate that question. It's funny, I'm starting to get that question more often, where before this happened, I rarely heard people ask me how I was doing. And I'm a person who works with 25 plus traumatized individuals per week. You know, in essence, I'm faring very well, and I'm faring well because though I'm a person of color, I'm of a certain age and background or community that this has recycled in terms of the storyline so much in my lifetime, that it's still very sad for me to watch. And that sadness that comes along with it at times does make me feel despair, but I don't stay there. And because I can identify that it would probably have that feeling for me if I persisted to watch, that I just decide more days than not to not allow myself exposure to it, because not only for what I do, but also how empathic I know that's not good for my health. I don't necessarily need to see a man being murdered on a loop to know that that's inhumane, and that there are many more people we don't even know or see that that's happened to. I live in a world that I read the news, I've read the news, I've read history. So to me, a lot of these occurrences are very familiar to my community. And I'm not, unfortunately, shocked, but I'm, of course, a human being and I'm saddened by it. And I think that to answer your other question, it's something we all should feel. I think that's a signal that you are human. If you feel sadness, if you feel disappointment in what you're seeing from the cops involved and the skin color of some of the people who were involved, I think there's a sense of rage because there's deep loss and sorrow. That's the grief that's associated with this. So I don't personally feel afraid for my life. I have felt at times, though, worried about my partner's life, because my partner is an African-American male. But I don't feel that all the time. I work on living in the present moment. I have a faith in a higher power, and I use that in conjunction with my compassionate social justice work to speak up. And also, this is the last thing I'll say, which is part of what the book is about. When I knew it was time for me to go, Marianne, from working in corporate positions that were unfulfilling, that were machinery in its approach to work, I accepted that whatever may come was worth more than I was receiving. Meaning, I knew that whatever experience I would have after leaving those jobs, because I was oftentimes overwhelmed, overworked, and underpaid, and not satisfied with my work, I knew there had to be something better. And so when I was forced to take the leap, because I had been fired twice after 14 years of working in my industry, never been fired, never had any grievances at my job, and was fired twice, two jobs in a row, due to the politics of the agency and some microaggressions, that when I left, I said, I will never turn around and go back to those places or work for other people that did not respect people who look like me, people who spoke up, people who had integrity in their work, so there was no regret. And working for myself has been the best decision ever, because I invested in me so that I put my health and my well-being at the forefront of everything that I do. So at this time or any other time, that's still very important to me. So that means I tune out from egregious content. I put messaging on my timeline to refute people being invasive of my privacy about what's going on and my voice in politics, etc. And I make sure that I share with people in my close circles to not inundate me with news that I know is going to devastate my psychology, because it's imperative for my work that I'm well. Mm-hmm. So I feel the sadness, of course, but I rise above the sadness so that I can be present to other people who may not have that closeness to themselves to give room to not attach to, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. No, it makes complete sense. And I have so much respect for you, one, you know, working for yourself, investing in yourself, knowing your worth, and two, utilizing your skills to help others, because I know you're very active in the mental health space, and that is so important to me. I did read a quote, you know, recently with this whole Black Lives Matter movement, saying that, you know, if you're not angry about the George Floyd murder, then you're not paying attention. And that really stood out to me, because I feel like it's a bit heartbreaking to know that not everybody, you know, is angry about this, and not everybody cares. But again, this is, you know, the society we live in. We can't, not everybody is going to have the same outlook on life. But in your opinion, I wanted to know, like, why do you think some people are empathetic and feel compassion, you know, to what's happening in the world, and are motivated to go to the streets and support the protests or do work, you know, offline, and there are others who aren't? Like, do you think that that does stem from the backgrounds and how we are raised, the society we live in? I'm just having a hard time kind of grasping, you know, almost like a common reaction that I think people should have, or I don't know if I'm just putting my own, you know, projections and judgment on them because it's not what I'm feeling.
I respect that you even said that.
Thank you.
Yeah, absolutely. But you're saying that is probably one of the most common experiences a lot of people are having, because that's the ambivalence of being impassioned about something you care about and wanting other people to care about it just the way that you do.
Mm-hmm.
So here's where there's a theme going on between social justice activism and racism. And it is the theme of folks tolerating difference.
Mm.
People have a very hard time tolerating difference, difference of opinion, difference of identity, difference in politics, difference in religion. One of the common reasons that marriages break up, besides for financial reasons, used to be that people had difference in religious politics. And still we live in a society as diverse as it is, and you as a New Yorker knows mm-hmm. this the way that I do, that we have so much difference here in our city, yet we are the most racialized city too. We have so many ethnic enclaves that never interact with one another. You can still go to parts of New York, although it's very gentrified, and still not see people of color. And so that speaks to what you're bringing up, which is this groupthink idea that in order to be an activist, or in order to be empowered, or in order for people to believe you care, you have to do it the way the majority is doing it. I think that's shameful, and it's mm-hmm. shaming. It's shaming people into doing what may not feel conscious for them to do, may not feel safe for them to do, and may not be the way that they identify with themselves is authentic to activating their power. So I think if we can let go of these judgments, that people care only if, because that's what that is, it's a judgment call, it's a projection onto mm-hmm. people, then we could ease that tension we have and start embracing the strengths of all the different voices and all the different ways that people can give back, because all aspects of the cause of BLM and other causes around freedom is important. We need people who can contribute money. We need people who can sign petitions. We need people who can write and call their legislatures. We need people who can actively protest. But if we're all doing one thing, how do all the other areas get the attention mm-hmm. they deserve?
No, I love that you said that, because actually today, the day that we're recording, I was struggling because, you know, I do have a platform and I just felt like it was such a fragile, like, line to kind of watch what I say and what I don't say. And if I post, people are going to say I'm not doing enough. And if I don't post, people assume that I don't care. And going back to what you said, like, not everything that you do needs to be publicized, right? I mean, this is even like with charity work. I know that people say if you're volunteering your time or you're donating or whatever, that's not something that you should be kind of bragging or saying like, hey, I'm going to do this. I think, again, that's also controversial. But what my whole point is just that, yes, you can share resources online and share exactly what you're doing, but we process things differently. We're humans. And I think this is such a, you know, important time in history right now. And there are different ways to kind of contribute. So I just love that you clarify that. But for those who, you know, maybe are anxious or can't go out and be, again, like doing these like actions that are very visible, like protests and all that, what can people do to support the BLM movement at home?
One, it's okay to state affirmations around this matter, such as radical acceptance statements, saying things like, I'm able to give financially at this time, and that is the most that I can do. Mm-hmm. Or, I'm able to sign a petition, and I will continue to be present to petitions that come forward, because that's the way that I'm most comfortable doing activism. Like, we need to affirm ourselves. We need to validate ourselves. And that work, that radical acceptance of being okay right where you are, that has to be done repeatedly, so mm-hmm. that when we hear messages or we feel attacked from other people, we feel messages of attack, or we hear things from other people that we believe is attacking, we counter that with those radical acceptance statements that I'm doing my part and that's good enough for me. And we state that and be clear about that. So from home, people can do all of those things. I just had a conversation with someone I'm working with who is experiencing some guilt. And I'm hearing that very often from my clients of remembering that there's COVID-19. How about that?
Yep.
And yeah, we're talking still in the news and hearing news about there may be a resurgence of COVID. And it may come sooner than we expect because people are protesting. What does that look like? It looks like what we've said it would look like. When you gather in public spaces with people who do not live with you, you're exposed and exposing yourself to COVID. So wait 14 days and we're gonna see what happens. So there's a lot of these things going on that we can't necessarily account for yet, such as people's feelings around what is enough, what, you know, needs to be done more of, and how do I remain healthy. So from your home, you can decide that you may want to attach to one organization or two, I would do more than two, that you contribute something to. You might sit in on a town hall. That's really important. Get information from reliable resources about what next action steps to take to be involved. What steps you could take to help pass legislation. We had two major bills get passed recently for Breonna Taylor and Eric Garner and George Floyd. So those things matter that you could do right from your seat. There's so many campaigns that are going on around BLM and the transgender community right now, who we are seeing underserved and not being recognized in the media for the issues that are going on right now during Pride Month. So a lot of things people can do. You can make phone calls. You can volunteer with an organization to spend an hour on your Saturday just calling different legislators and helping to get things passed. You can go online and do more reading. There are a lot of people, Marianne, that don't know history. Mm-hmm. Yet the books are right there for us to access and download on different apps. So do more studying, do more learning. Learn about the movements that came before so we can take from those movements and tweak them and make them better for the modern times that we're living in.
Yeah, I think everything you said, it was so helpful, and I hope that the listeners get something out of that. I know that you work with a lot of clients right now, and they're probably telling you about their struggles and, you know, what they're going through, how they're feeling. But I want to ask you, what keeps you up at night? I know there's a lot going on in the world, and you can talk about COVID, you can talk about the BLM movement, or just something else that's happening. But currently, what is stressing you out?
That's a good question. I don't think anyone's asked me that yet. What stresses me out?
Because, you know, they say New Yorkers, we have so much stress in our lives. And that is why I always need a vacation. And I'm like itching to go away. But I think we manage. I don't even know if we manage stress. I think sometimes we are unaware of our stress. But considering your background, I feel like you're definitely, you know, a very observant and self-analytical person. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I'm just curious. Like, what are you going through? What's happening?
You know, I don't want this to sound egalitarian. I don't even know if that's the word I wanted to use. I don't want this to sound sort of ethereal so that people don't relate to it. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I feel stressed, but it's because of, I think, sometimes my ambivalence with the work I've done on myself to mm-hmm. not take on other people's stress. Mm-hmm. And also be mindful of my principles. So as an example to this idea is that I value friendship. I value authentic, honest, which I will see is the same thing or similar, direct, loving friendship. And for me, that might include that people who I know right now who are going through loss of various kinds to people who are feeling anxious in my circles, to people who are doing other things with their lives and they want to talk and share, I have to balance my days with the clients I work with who are feeling lots of things from pre-COVID to now, mm-hmm. and the people who want my attention, who I want to give my attention to in my personal life. And I've had to carve out, and I do this very intentionally, I carve out the days that I just focus on work, and then the days that I focus on me and my loved ones. Mm-hmm. And sometimes that's not at the same time. So I might just dedicate a couple of hours, like an hour on Thursday and an hour on a Friday, to actually have a tea date or a virtual date with a friend. Mm-hmm. But then the other hours, I don't talk on the phone. I don't engage in texting too much. I literally just tune into me and my lover, and we just enjoy our time and we enjoy what that looks like. It might be both of us just sitting in the same room and watching a movie, or being in different rooms and me reading a book and him watching something on TV that he likes. So that for me is very cathartic, and I do that purposefully, and I do that without apology so that I don't attach to other people's energy and stress. And I'm very vocal. I tell people, like, I don't mind, you know, having a phone call here or there, I guess it's getting a call, but I need to be off in an hour because I need to unwind. Like, I'm very forthcoming, so people don't guess what I'm feeling. Mm-hmm. They know that, like, I'm here, I'm present now, and I want to be, and I enjoy this, and I hope it's not off-putting, but that I can't do that for prolonged periods of time because I'm used to giving my time away, and I need that time to myself sometimes too. So my stress is really just managing those different spaces that I'm in, and I don't tend to feel guilt about it. I tend to feel some anxiety though of trying to keep up with it all. So I give myself permission to like surrender, know that people know who I am. They know that I'm active in social activism and social justice work through my work as a therapist. And at the same time that this friendship goes both ways. So friends can reach out to me when they're available and vice versa. And they don't take it personally.
Yeah, I mean, I'm hearing that you have mastered the concept of setting boundaries, which is something that I'm learning to do. And I love that you are also prioritizing your self-care, because given what you do, I can tell that you give a lot, you know, you give, because that's what you have to do. And you also receive, right, by listening. And there we as human beings have a capacity for how much we can take before we need to fill ourselves up. And I'm really happy that you have learned to also carve out time to prioritize your own mental health, because as a mental health advocate, you need to be, you know, good yourself before helping others. So as you know, we kind of touched upon this in the beginning, but this podcast is called The City Confessions. So I'm not sure if you saw this coming, but as we're wrapping up this episode, I do want to ask you, what is your confession? And it's funny that you mentioned, you know, your I guess, how do I say, like your approach to the word confessions. I know that it can be a little confusing or uncomfortable, but I want to preface this by saying that I believe that my platform is a safe platform for you to share whatever you're comfortable sharing with. And there is no pressure to come up with a good confession, because I think some people are like, oh my God, I don't know what to say. I need to come up with something good. That's not the point. It can be something very surface level or deep. And you can take time to think about that. But if you were to complete the sentence of my confession is, what would that be?
That's a great one. Ironically enough, I didn't see that coming. I probably should have, based on the title of the show. I thought about it as you were speaking. I really was present to every word that you were saying. And this is something I'm really happy to release, which is I don't have all the answers. Mm-hmm. That is why I'm a listener. Mm-hmm. And of course, I talk back to my clients, but I'm mostly listening to them, and listening to what they're saying, and listening to what they're not saying, which is the unconscious. Mm. But I don't have all the answers, and I'm comfortable, and I'm also in the process, ongoing process of reminding myself to say that more often, that I don't know. I don't know the answer. I don't know what's right for you, because there is this myth, Marianne, that therapists are saviors.
Yep.
And I refute that, because I tell people all the time, it's sacred work what we do, to be present and honor the space that we go into each and every time we meet with the client, and that's multiple times a day, and to not put your agenda forward, but just to be there for other people. Yet this idea, when people think of me, they think of what I do for a living, and I always debunk that with, I am not what I do. I love what I do, but I'm not what I do. I'm more than that. So as I help to heal myself through my own therapy that I went through, my psychoanalysis that I went through for 3 years, three times a week, I help to heal myself, and that is what I help other people do. So that means I can't have all the answers for you, because I'm not you.
Wow.
I don't know it all.
That was deep. I love that. Thank you. Piggyback off of that, what is your biggest reward with being a psychotherapist?
My biggest reward is actually watching people transform their lives, because I don't take credit for that. I'm a vessel, and I know that, and that's why this work is very sacred, because it's a spiritual type of work, and I don't bring religion or necessarily even spirituality into my work unless that's where the client is. But because this work is so valuable to not just the individual who's coming in for treatment, but the individual and all of the relationships that one individual has to their work, their partners, their children, their parents, their friends, themselves. So within one, there's many. And that witnessing process is really beautiful to see someone go from maybe being very depressed so that their thoughts are so disjointed and they're disconnected from themselves and maybe they have made really poor decisions in their lives and their relationships to now centering themselves, being more self-focused and self-loving, to asking for what they want and need and clearing themselves of toxic unhealthy relationships with their jobs, their families, their friends, former friends, their lovers, and food even, and other addictive things. So seeing that process and being patient with that process is really very rewarding for me. And I know I've done my work.
Mm-hmm. I also feel like, you know, therapy, again, is another word that has been used a lot on social media recently. But I'm happy that I think there is this barrier that has been somewhat broken down a little bit in saying that it's not, you know, so taboo, right? What do you have to say about, do you believe, first of all, that everybody can use therapy? And two, what are the misconceptions about therapy?
Great question. So the first thing is, yeah, absolutely everybody can use therapy. Everybody, I think, needs some self-development. And that might come through therapy or that might come through a course that you take. Like people go to a course on miracles. People go to a course on self-development. People go to a course on EQ. You can get that work in so many different ways. I have a blog to help people develop themselves. So yes, I think everyone can benefit from therapy, but it also has to start from the person seeing themselves where they are, and that's very uncomfortable. If you don't like certain things about yourself or your life, or you've been told certain things about yourself that you don't accept, and you've seen it come up many times before, getting closer to that part of you is really uneasy, and it keeps people from seeking help. But when they see that it's hurting their lives, their relationships, and maybe other aspects of their health, that's sometimes what brings people in. But it doesn't have to just be that. You don't need to just be in crisis to come into therapy. So yes, I think more people can benefit from it. The misconceptions are some of the things that we've talked about so far, including that your therapist is going to save you. Your therapist is going to fix you. If you're coming in as a couple, this is very common, that one person in the partnership thinks that the therapist is going to agree with the person who sought the therapy for the couple. That's often not the case. That also it's a quick fix. People think that, oh, I'll pay for a couple of sessions and I'll be just fine. And that most times does not happen either. So where I start with clients when they begin therapy with me is, what are your expectations? Because we need to look at that. We need to examine, right, what are your expectations with this process and with me as your therapist. And that, I think, catches people off guard because they don't expect that. They expect that I'm going to tell them what to do. That's another misconception of therapy. I don't tell people what to do. You come to your own conclusions. You come to your own revelations by just hearing yourself and me giving you feedback. So those things are very common in therapy, and that's why I talk with people in that first session post intake. What do you hope to get from therapy? And we continue to unpack that. What do you expect of me as your therapist? What were you imagining this relationship would do for you?
Right. Okay. So I want to take a moment right now to just acknowledge your virtual presence. The amazing knowledge and insight that you have offered me and the listeners, and just you taking time out of your day to come speak with me, because from what I've learned with just recording podcasts and doing this is that time is a gift, that when two people say yes, it's something that's so valuable to me, and I don't ever take that for granted. Given what you do and the state of the world right now, you can definitely have this time to yourself. So for you saying yes, I just want to sincerely thank you for that and really just appreciate all the amazing work that you are doing for others.
Thank you so much.
Of course. And I do have two more questions before we wrap it up. So the second to last is pretty simple. What are you up to? What can people be on the lookout for? I do know you have a book, Adulting as a Millennial, A Guide to Everything Your Parents Didn't Teach You, and I will link that in the description. But do you have any secret projects that you can reveal, or what can people be on the lookout from you, Asha, within the next 3 months, 6 months, 2020? What can you tell us?
Yeah, that's an exciting question. My book, launching it, is really big. It took me almost 6 months to complete it. So we're in pre-orders right now, and this is the month of June, but the book's dropped in June. So I'm praying people continue to purchase the pre-order so that they can get it at a discounted rate, and then read it, share it when they do get it in the mail, and tell people where about it. Also, my new services that we've added to lifecoachasha.com, which includes compassion worksheets, compassion. Mm-hmm. We have one right now that's free and downloadable, compassion journaling and compassion coaching. And I'm super psyched about those things because for the reason that we've been speaking about social justice today, I created this service and product. I have a compassion journal that's in white and a compassion journal that's in black that people can order from us, and also they can book a session because folks are suffering. And the way that I think we can help people to heal themselves and others is to bring compassion to conversation and the work that we're doing and the ways in which we treat our individual selves. So look for that to grow. I want to do more of that in groups. I want to do that with protesters, activists, children, couples, families. I think that's going to be very appealing for folks. So I'm excited about that. And lastly, I just taped something super special that will be released in the fall, and it's going to be on television.
Ooh.
And it's an important conversation around what's happening in the world and how people are dealing with their grief and how we can find ways and solutions that would help people to confront and live with grief in a way that's sensitive to their needs. So be on the lookout to see you on television at the beginning of the fall, and I'll be sharing that on my timeline so people can follow me on Twitter or Instagram and get more detail when that's closer to be released.
Yes, I will leave all of your social links in the description so people can follow you. And last but not least, what is the one thing you love most about yourself?
Oh, wow.
Because, girl, we are ending this on a positive note. I'm all about positivity, and I think that's the best way for you personally to look into yourself. You probably have like a whole list, but just give me the first one that pops into your mind.
No, I don't have a whole list. I want to
You should.
In this lifetime as I can be. That's a great question, though.
Thank you.
For that too. The one thing that you said I like about myself.
No, not like. What is the one thing you love about yourself?
Ooh, see, that's already difficult. I've already switched up in my brain. The one thing I love, which is... See, I would even use a different word because that's something that I'm trying to get close to for myself. I love my brain.
Mm.
I actually just said that to my partner the other day because I'm noticing the more I focus on me and what I want to do in this lifetime, I am so intentional about what I don't want to do and what I don't want to be a part of, which includes what we've spoken about today, mm-hmm. which is I don't want to be a part of people's drama. Mm-hmm. I don't want to be a part of conversations that are homogenous and the derogatory messaging attached to that. I don't want to be a part of any of that gossip, none of those things that tear people down. So I avoid conversations with people who do that. And as a result of me being very intentional about how I spend my time and what I want to do, I feel so much more joy in my life. And I notice that I learn and adapt information a lot quicker than I did ever before. And I think it was because I was moving like the speed of lightning, and I was doing too many different things and trying to keep up with too many different things and people and places. And now, because I don't have all of that, some people have let me go, and I've let some relationships go, and I've been quarantining for 3.5 months, and I've really just been very intentional about where I'm headed. Mm-hmm. I notice how quickly my brain adapts to information, retains it, and is able to compute it and put it back out into the world as digestible information to help others. So that for me is my
superpower.
That's my superpower, and I love my brain.
Yeah, no, I love hearing that. I honestly feel like I can talk to you for longer, and I have so many, like, everything you say, I'm like, yes, that's so true. And my brain is also like processing what you're saying, and then like I feel like I have like, you know, questions, like follow up questions. But we will end on that note since it was a beautiful way, and I'm actually so happy to like have you end my season 3, because I feel like, one, it's very relevant to what's happening in the world. I usually obviously pre-record, but this is actually going to launch next week, so it's very again appropriate to the timing. And
that's,
I think,
wonderful.
Yeah, everything you said was so helpful, and I really do hope you guys for listening that got something out of it, because I know for me, I definitely have. I honestly also mark like little time ticks where you said something really cool or good, and I've marked it just so I can go back to it and like, you know, rehear it, if that makes sense. But Asha, thank you again so much for coming on and, you know, sprinkling your wisdom to all of us. And I will leave all of your information in the description, as I have mentioned previously. I hope you guys enjoyed this episode. I will release a solo one just to wrap it up, and then come back in August, because your girl needs a break as well.
Self-care.
But again, thank you so much, Asha. It was amazing. And I definitely want to keep in touch with you, because that's what I do with all my guests. I hate having just like a one-off type of thing. So, you know, be prepared to have, you know, messages and emails from me in the future. I might bug you a little, but... hopefully that's okay.
Reach out. Connect. Stay connected.
Yes, for sure. All right. Thank you again. And I hope you guys enjoyed this episode, and stay tuned for next week's. Bye.